You're listening to the Northern Football Podcast with Ben Steiner, Peter Galindo, and Alexander Gonge-Ruzic.
Welcome inside the Northern Football Podcast. It's episode 98, post-match edition from Canada's loss to Belgium. And it was a close one, 1-0. Michy Batshuayi, the difference just at the end of the first half by Canada with a very encouraging performance against Belgium. Peter, welcome back into the podcast. You were there in the stadium. Alex, I know you were watching from Canada. Just your initial thoughts on that match and Canada's close loss.
First of all, don't even know how I'm alive right now because I have been running on basically 3 hours sleep every night since I've been here, but worth it. What a night that was. It was an amazing spectacle. Kudos to every Canadian fan inside the stadium for making what was an incredible atmosphere from the moment I stepped into the stadium at about 8 p.m. local all the way until after the full-time whistle when the players and John Herdman and the staff were applauding the players for what was a really strong effort, maybe a little stronger than some people were expecting, but ultimately won in futility because they couldn't get the win. But a lot of positive signs, which I'm sure we're going to get into. And it is on to Croatia on Sunday after this, which we'll preview, I'm sure, in depth.
I'm watching in Canada. That's what stuck with me. I'm like, damn, Canada's a big country. But anyways, kind of relevant. I did watch from Canada and I enjoyed from Canada. It was a good little game. I mean, in the end, fine margins at the top level. That's the flip side of you play really well and you show off to the world stage, but also the reality that, yeah, this was an opportunity to get some important points on the board. So it's kind of that flip side of, you know, being proud of the team for how they went out and just dominated and played and kind of set the tone and showed what's possible, but also a bit of frustration because this Belgian side was there for the taking and there to be picked, and it just, you know, moments decided the game. So bit of a flip side to that coin, but it was still very positive to see Canada make its World Cup debut. World Cup return felt like a debut. It's just been so long. Different era of football from the last time the men's team was on the world stage. So just nice to see them go and ball out, and you know, a lot of good emotions associated with that. But in terms of the game itself, it's one where it's like how the balance of playing well, but then also feels like one that just got away.
Yeah, to me it was very overly positive initially because there were a lot of people within Canada and abroad that were just surprised that Canada could ball like it did. Canada dominated that game for the first 60 minutes. You saw Estacio nutmeg the best midfielder, best player in the world. You saw Canada create a ton of chances, dominate the game, have the better of the expected goals, have the better of the chances. Of course, it was all, as you say, in futility, but it showed that Canada belonged on the world stage, and I think that is a victory in and of itself. But then again, this was the more winnable game of the group, even despite the FIFA rankings, that Canada doesn't get anything out of it. But they were close in the 10th minute. Alphonso Davies steps up to the penalty spot and doesn't finish past Thibaut Courtois. And that was the question that a lot of our listeners had. And we'll start off with Ryan Burns. Why do you think Davies took that PK? I know the players decide he's not a bad choice, but I think Jonathan David would have been a better choice. A few listeners calling for Stefan Eustachio, Steve Vitoria. There's other choices on this team other than Alphonso Davies stepping up to the spot.
There are, but you know, I was not surprised to see him be the one to do it. And for months, this team has said it's pretty much a decision by committee. And whoever feels confident in the moment is going to step up and take it. We saw Lucas Cavallini do it against Japan. We've seen countless players in the past do it for the national team. And the one thing I will credit Davies for is that he had the cojones to step up in that situation and really try to show that he is the star of the team, because that's what star players do. They rise in those big moments. And, you know, to his credit, he did take it on. Sure, Jonathan David might have been a more logical choice just because he is the penalty taker for Lille. I know people were saying, oh, his penalty record's pretty good. I think he's, what, 6-9, 9-12, something like that. So, like, it's fairly solid. But, listen, it was just a really poorly hit penalty at the end of the day for me, and Courtois read it really well. Because look, when you are a left footer and you take a slightly angled run up, your chances are you're going to shoot it to your left. That's exactly what happened. I could see Davies was trying to get a little bit of a whip on it to kind of tuck it into that far post. Just couldn't get his foot around it enough. And it ends up being a decent save from Courtois, but an easier save than I think he probably would have been expected to make. And to Canada's credit, they did react well after the penalty. But as soon as VAR awarded it, guys, I'm not going to lie, Peru-Denmark vibes from 4 years ago started hitting me right in that moment. I turned to Christian Jack in the press box and said, this is very much starting to look like Peru. They dominate early. They get a penalty from VAR. They fail to capitalize on it. They still dominate after that. And then they ultimately lose 1-0 off a quick counter. And sure enough, that's precisely what happened. I feel like I am now the cursed one. So,
yeah, I mean, the penalty, it's kind of one of those where I'm not surprised to see Alphonso Davies step up. He's the guy, and I think, you know, it's kind of credit to him in a sense for wanting to step up and take that penalty, because there's also the reality of if he doesn't step up and take that penalty and say it gets missed, because penalties are a tough proposition, and something like this is Thibaut Courtois' fifth penalty save of the year, so that's kind of something he also just does, is he's super freakishly long and just gets down to these sort of shots and makes them look so effortless. Like the fact that he was just able to parry away what was still a pretty powerful and low attempt from Alphonso Davies. Because then you get the question of, oh, your star players or maybe, you know, skirting responsibility. Is he willing to step up? And I think on one hand, you can only applaud that confidence to want to step up and want to be that guy. Maybe it's something where, you know, you do look at a guy like Jonathan David, but he's in good form. He's, you know, banging home the goals. You do wonder if he could take the penalty, but it's one of those things where I'm just like, it's such a fluid situation. And what I find with penalties, there's a lot of hindsight. There's a lot of whataboutism. There's a lot of just looking at the result and not necessarily the process. And the one take I've seen, I don't know if we've had it in our rundown, but it's like, oh, John Herdman should have decided ahead of time. I don't think anything would have necessarily changed by that, because I see a lot of, oh, you should decide your penalty beforehand, before you even get in the stadium. I mean, what good does that make if, you know, what if Thibaut Courtois is standing on your side? Are you still going to put it in that? I've always just found that argument ridiculous. I think penalties are one of those things where it's about 80% of your run-up and, you know, 20% where you actually put it. And the great thing about the run-up is you don't know how those things feel until you're in the moment. You don't know, you know, Alphonso Davies sitting there for a minute, maybe the nerves just got to him, maybe it hit him. And for all of those reasons, I don't particularly care about the result of the penalty. It's not something where I'm like, oh, Canada bundled what went on. And I think statistically, if you're going to bring up that argument, well, since John Herdman's been in charge, they've had the same system. And that was only the second penalty miss that I can think of off the top of my head. Statistics aren't fully accurate. I've researched them and they're missing some of them that I can think of. But if you date back to the start of 2021 as a reference point, Alphonso Davies himself has scored two. Kyle Larin scored a couple, one at the Gold Cup, a couple in World Cup qualifying. Junior Hoilett's put one away, if I'm not mistaken, at the Gold Cup. You know, Alphonso Davies put one away in Nations League. The only miss I can think of since John, oh yeah, obviously we had Lucas Cavallini last week with his Panenka and one in World Cup qualifying. The only miss I can think of was Marc-Anthony Kay, Cayman Islands, and he wasn't a natural penalty taker. He was just on a brace and he stepped up and probably asked for it to try and get his hat trick and he ended up missing. So John Herdman's had the system for 2 years now and it's had about 8 or 9 penalties. They've scored all of them except one for about an 80% rate, which is what takers tend to score at. So I don't know. It's just one of those where you miss on a big stage and all of a sudden things are getting questioned. And if you look at the stats, the facts behind some of the decisions, it doesn't necessarily add up to some of the, you know, questions that were surrounding the whole penalty situation.
The fact that it took Davies a minute between the penalty getting awarded and then him actually taking it, I think actually had a pretty massive influence in the overall outcome, because the longer it seems, at least, a player takes to attempt the penalty and he puts the ball down and he's kind of waiting to take it, the more he kind of has to overthink it, right? And maybe get in his head a little bit. And I wonder if that probably influenced things as well, because how could that brain not be racing in that moment with everything on the line in that situation?
Yeah, I think that has to go through his mind as well. The fact that it was 65 seconds from the moment that the foul occurred to the VAR check to him actually getting to the spot and being able to take that shot on Courtois, it's too much time, and that's what you're going to get with VAR. They get the call right at the end of the day, and that's the most important thing. But it does take too much time, and that applies a little too much pressure to the player, I think. But then again, big players need to step up in big moments, and Alphonso Davies had the balls to take on that shot, but he couldn't finish, and it is what it is. I don't want to spend too much time on a missed penalty. Courtois is a quality goalkeeper on penalties and from 12 yards. So Davies doesn't come up in the big moment, but Courtois, he's got a lot of strength at that. So I'm not surprised that he gets the stop. The question is, though, if Canada gets another penalty kick at this tournament in the group stage, does Davies step up and take it?
I think there's a strong chance he will, but it all depends, again, who's feeling the confidence in that moment, who's willing to take it on. I'm sure Davies is still going to want to take it, just based on he is the star. He is someone who enjoys and embraces that moment. So I'm sure that if a situation presented itself again, he will want to step up, and I'm sure that the discourse is going to be what it is. But as Alex pointed out, the numbers don't lie. Sure, not a lot of those penalties are taken on a stage as big as the World Cup, but at the end of the day, they've converted relatively consistently. The one time they didn't, it just so happened to come in the biggest situation. So there's really not a lot to read into in that regard until you get a much bigger sample size in matches of the magnitude, or even close to the magnitude of the World Cup.
Yeah, I think for the next penalty, it's probably going to be Jonathan David if he's on the field, and or Kyle Larin. I think, you know, it's one of those where Alphonso Davies felt to his right for the moment. If he's feeling up for it again, I mean, credit to him. That would take, again, more a lot of courage to step up again. But I think, yeah, it's one of those where it's fluid. And honestly, I have no problems with the approach, because you're damned if you do, if damned if you don't. Because one thing that's worth noting is that, you know, I saw that Thibaut Courtois kind of asked about the penalty saves, and it sounds like he had obviously heavily scouted Canada's takers, and someone like Jonathan David and Alphonso Davies have a good database. So I imagine if David stepped up, I mean, he's taken 12 penalties, and, you know, he does tend to favor certain sides for Lille. So again, it's one of those where it's damned if you do, damned if you don't. I just think, yeah, whoever's feeling it, if it's Kyle Larin, if it's Jonathan David, I think personally I'd love to see Jonathan David to step up, just because there's been all this discourse around, oh, why doesn't he take it? I think David just stepping up and bearing home, you know, I think that would be a good confidence booster from the Iceman. But otherwise, it's something where it's just like, again, I think the penalty discourse is one of those things where you look at the results, and you know, if Canada scores, and I bet you that's, oh, Herdman's a genius for the penalty system. Everyone looks confident. Everyone looks great. But it's one of those where it gets judged on the outcome, and sometimes fairly unfairly so.
And from Blair Donnelly, as well as Francois Bousclair, should Vitória take the penalty kicks? There's not as much of a database on him taking penalty kicks, especially for the national team. He's been able to finish penalty kicks at the club level, but he's never really taken that opportunity with Canada.
I feel like the answer, regardless of who people suggest, is going to be the same, in that if he's feeling it, go for it, right? And he's someone who has experience doing that. So I say, why not, if he's willing to take it?
And Davies takes on a big challenge by taking on that penalty kick as well. But he puts in a fairly good game otherwise, especially being his first competitive game back after an injury. But is he over-criticized? That being the question from Star.
I think that's going to come with the territory, in that you miss a penalty, you're the star player, you're the one player that most casual fans will recognize, and when you don't score or assist or really have a dramatic positive impact on the game, I'm talking, you know, anything that just even a casual soccer fan can see, oh, Davies had a good game, then he's inevitably going to get criticized a lot. Was it his best game? No. Could he have done a little bit more? Yes. Was he deployed in a role that might have limited him somewhat? Yes. But I think that actually had more to do with the fact that he's coming back from a hamstring injury. And I think when he was playing deeper, he was actually quite effective, coming in from left wing back and you know, cutting into the middle and kind of having his influence on the game, because he had a couple of key passes before and after the penalty. And then I think when Herdman made the subs that he made and then swapped roles between Buchanan and Davies, that's when you started to see a little bit of a decrease in play from both of them, actually. So I feel like Davies for me would have been like a 6, 6.5 out of 10, but I don't think he was anywhere near as bad as some people are making him out to be. And at the end of the day, he was trying to progress the ball. He was trying to get through what ended up becoming, at least in the second half, a very compact and disciplined Belgian defense. They were magnificent at just blocking shots at the very last moment, at getting in the middle of passing lanes, as I think I cut out there, but I will edit that out because I know that for me it's going to record, but for you guys, you probably wouldn't have heard what I just said. So anyway, I will keep going. So I think overall Davies had a decent game, but by far and away, not his best game.
Yeah, I think Alphonso Davies is always going to take that brunt of attention from, you know, those, just because you look at Canada and you look at, you know, at Alphonso Davies. And I think sometimes, I guess, like Peter mentions, it's the territory, but also sometimes it doesn't necessarily, you know, the shoe doesn't fit, so to speak. You know, I thought again in this game, he was solid, all things considered, with the injury. In terms of his deployment, I did think the left wing back role was one where it suited for the first 60 minutes, and I think it was smart that he did eventually get moved up. It was one of those where I think we also maybe, you know, noticed, and I'm going to have to look for this on the rewatch, we kind of noticed how important a guy like Sam Adekugbe is to the team. I mean, again, not much of a surprise, but obviously he doesn't start, and it's one of those where I think Richie Larea was a deserved starter, and it's such a tough question of how do you get both Richie Larea and Sam Adekugbe on, because they're both so good in, you know, slightly different ways, and that Larea is going to just be, you know, a lot so relentless in the final third. He's going to bring you that spark, whereas a guy like Adekugbe, he's going to just bring you this ball progression from deep that helps you on that left side and does free up Davies. So I think Davies was one of those. His role was, he was good. He was very good in that wing back role, I'd say, in the sense that he defended, you know, sneakily well, and he had a few good moments of progression, but it also felt like it allowed Belgium just to close him off a few times and limit his ability to just run at guys and you know, and progress the ball a little more than I would have, you know, you could tell there a few times where Davies just wanted to go and then he'd look up and see a wave of red shirts. But overall, I think the thing is with Davies, he's kind of just, he's going to get the brunt of the attention no matter what. It's either going to be, oh, he's taking all the touches, well, it's hero ball, or it's, you know, he's not getting enough touches, oh, why isn't Alphonso Davies accepting responsibility, it's, you know, he takes a penalty, oh, why is he stepping up, and then if he doesn't take the penalty, it's, you know, why isn't he stepping up, and then, you know, it's his deployment's always going to be questioned. It's tough because, again, it's a fluid situation. There's some games where you're going to need him in certain roles, and I thought John Herdman did well to start him in that left wing back role, and now it's going to be curious to see where to use him against Croatia, because I mean, as we'll kind of talk in the Croatia game, for Croatia versus Morocco did such a good job of pinning back Croatia's fullbacks, and someone like Borna Sosa, excellent ball progressing fullback, he didn't get forward as much as he could have, and when he did, he almost created all of Croatia's goals, kind of came through Borna Sosa getting up the field and getting the ball into the box. So if you're looking, like, if you're Canada, like, okay, maybe you want to find a way to pin hit, you know, Croatia's fullbacks down, and maybe that means playing Tejan Buchanan and Alphonso Davies higher up the pitch to do that. So again, it's one of those where each game there's a different tactical wrinkle to how Davies plays, and I think because of that, like, Davies has such a unique role for Canada in the sense that some days, like the Uruguay game, he's going to be their primary creator and he's going to have 6 key passes and he's going to look like a number 10. And some days he's going to have to be a wing back. Some days he's going to have to be a fullback. Some days he's going to have to be a winger. And, you know, you look at in this game, he had to play a little deeper and maybe it looks, you know, creates a role where it doesn't look like he's as involved. But nice thing is with Davies, he's going to give you a job no matter where he is on the pitch.
And you mentioned Sam Adekugbe not getting in the starting 11, Richie Larea getting in the starting 11. And I do think Larea had a fantastic match. I think he was one of Canada's best players on the pitch in terms of both the way he tracked back defensively and cutting into the box as well. Probably maybe deserved a couple of penalty calls. We'll get to that, I'm sure, because we've got 66 question submissions from you, seemingly an apt number for a match against the Red Devils. But moving on to a question from Mark East that sort of gets us a little bit more into this match and away from just Alphonso Davies and the penalty kick. Most commentary lauds Canada's effort but laments its poor finishing. Is it simply a question of quality, or are there adjustments the CanMNT can make in this area ahead of the next 2 games?
I don't think it's really a quality issue. I think, like John Herdman said, it was one of those nights where they just weren't ruthless. They took 22 shots, 21 if you take away the penalty, 1.82 non-penalty expected goals, for an average of about 0.086 XG per shot. That is about what they averaged during World Cup qualifying. The difference is they seldom went up against quality goalkeepers at the level of Thibaut Courtois. They seldom went up against quality teams like Belgium and or, you know, sides that kind of had that game-breaking ability like Belgium. More often than not, Canada was the team with superior individual quality, and eventually quantity, even if the shot quality is lower, will eventually reign supreme. But the chances of that happening are lessened in these sort of situations. So I don't think it'll happen again, because the one thing that we've learned about this team, and I think this is going to be a common thing when we talk about some of the areas where things didn't go well, they seldom make the same mistake twice in a row. So I feel like if they get similar opportunities, they're going to pull the trigger a lot sooner, because there were times when Kyle Larin maybe took an extra touch than he needed to. There were times when Jonathan David had other options rather than shooting and didn't take them. I don't think he'll end up missing that opportunity again. And let's be honest, they're not going up against Thibaut Courtois again. So that's to me going to be the real thing to watch here is, can they have that ruthlessness in front of goal after showing that, hey, we probably should have pulled the trigger a lot sooner?
I think they're going to have to find a way to be a little sharper, I think, in front of goal. It just feels like Canada right now, they lack that sort of ruthlessness. And it's a credit that they were able to create so much. Ultimately, it was interesting to see. SofaScore had them at 2.7 total XG. YScore had them at 3.3 XG, interestingly enough. So, you know, depending on the model, you could even say Canada created more than some of the models showed. So again, I think Canada did well to create chances, but ultimately what the difference is when I look at the stats is that they didn't test Thibaut Courtois enough. One thing that's, you know, stuck out as a theme is there's too many times where Canada gets into good positions and they're not, you know, hitting the target. They had 3 shots on target out of 22 of their shots. Ultimately, if you're doing that, that's not going to be, you know, you're not going to score many goals when you hit the target just 3 times. And I think that's one thing that stood out from Canada is watching how well they do to create chances, but then they just, for whatever reason, they take that extra second and then let a defender get in the way, or they pass when they should shoot, or they should shoot when they should pass. It just feels like right now, I think Canada, and maybe this is just part of the adjustment of to the next level, is that in CONCACAF World Cup qualifying, they had the time to take these sorts of, you know, touches and take that time. Even against top teams, you think of goals like Kyle Larin against the US, he runs into the box, takes a touch and just rips it far corner. You know, if it's against Belgium, you're not getting that sort of time in such a moment, and teams aren't giving you those sorts of chances. So it's one of those for Canada. It's been interesting. If you look now, it's been a while. You look at, you know, Uruguay, they didn't score any goals despite getting a whole boatload of chances. Against Japan, they scored two set pieces. They actually didn't score an open play. There were a few times in open play where they got it and hesitated and waited. You look, since World Cup qualifying, that's been something to look at. Even, again, a situation you could use is when they played in Honduras and it was that rainy pitch. Yeah, the pitch sucked, but they still had a few chances, but because of the pitch, they waited a little more. And it feels like in moments where they wait a little bit, they've been a bit hesitant and it's kind of cost them. So I think if you're Canada, you want to see a little more ruthlessness. You want to see some first time finishing. You want to see some just, you know, putting your boot through it kind of moments, because they do such a great job of creating chances. I think creating chances is no longer the issue. It's more just like, okay, when you get the ball in certain areas, it's just, I think, look at Mishi Batshuayi. The fact that he had the ball in the box for half a second and just whacked it home first time, that's the difference, again, between a team that takes its chances. That they know that when the ball comes, they're going to put it home, you know, as quickly and incisively as possible. And Canada has shown an ability to create that cutting edge. They just need to finish with that cutting edge.
And I think you can look at Kyle Larin in particular when he came in. There were a few chances where you maybe want him to hit that first time. And I think when he's at Beşiktaş, with the confidence that he had in Turkey, he probably hits the chance first time. But playing at Club Bruges, and not necessarily getting the rhythm that he needs at that club. He hesitated on a few chances, and that cost Canada what could have been a much better opportunity and a chance to score. But a question from Evan Murray. I'm curious on your thoughts on how much expected goals matters in tournaments like this. I thought Canada played great and the XG models agree, but it doesn't feel significant beyond that.
In small sample sizes, they tend to mean less than in larger sample sizes. That's kind of the benefit of expected goals, is that you can always kind of sense trends based on what you see in underlying numbers. So, and that's why whenever I'm making player radars and stuff, I always wait until a player has about 600-700 minutes under his belt before drawing any sort of statistical conclusions. Because it goes without saying, the larger the sample size when you're dealing with underlying numbers or stats in general, the better picture you can paint. You can still glean certain things like, oh, hey, they very clearly dominated chances because look at the quality of the chances they created. Look at the steady progression of chances that they created. If you look at an XG plot, for example, over time. But again, really outside of, I would say, two, possibly three opportunities, Canada didn't really generate anything that was quote unquote dangerous. But then again, Belgium also had two or three. Two of them were blocked, and then one of them was converted. So, you know, really, in that way, everything was split right down the middle. And the fact that we're even talking about this post-Belgium is probably more than we probably could have anticipated.
I think the XG, there's a lot you could take from it, I think, personally. I think it's one of those where, yes, it doesn't affect the most important outcome, which is the result. But that's also just tournament soccer. Like, there's just games where you look at Saudi Arabia versus Argentina. Yeah, it's a game where, you know, Saudi Arabia played above their XG, for example. And, you know, they certainly defensively, you know, Argentina's XG doesn't look as, like, yeah, Argentina got 2.2 XG, but did they really threaten Saudi Arabia? And that's a credit to Saudi Arabia. But there's just the reality that if you go out and generate 2.2 XG every game, you're going to get goals. And, you know, that's the thing with the XG is that if you can, what I like about it is that it rates you getting into the area and consistent, you know, the one thing I guess you could say about XG is, yeah, it doesn't necessarily weight shots as equal as one game. You can have a 0.10, you know, XG shot and you're completely off. It's like a, you know, Jonathan David back foot header where it is a 0.10 XG shot, but feels like a 0.01. And then there's a 0.10 XG where it's Kyle Larin running into that space, you know, between the 6-yard box and the edge of the box where he's just so good at finishing and it feels more than XG. But I think consistently, if you get into those areas, you're going to create goals. And I think trends are important. And yeah, it's one of those where it's unfortunate. It's like, yeah, XG doesn't actually win games, but consistently, as we've seen over the course of league seasons, over big competitions, teams that tend to do well in creating XG and limiting XG tend to do better, because who would have thought the more chances you create, the less shots that go against you tend to perform. So obviously we want Canada to keep it up and we want a bigger sample size from this tournament before we determine, oh, this and that. But I think the fact they went out and did super well on XG is positive, just because it's, again, the process is there. You'd rather them go out and do that than, you know, especially for a younger team like this, than go out and, you know, get dominated, but then you win. It's like, yes, you win, but also the sustainability of that could come crashing down to earth and catch up to you later. But ultimately, that's the balance of a results-based business. It's, you're going to be judged on results. But also for a young team like Canada, you have 2026 on the horizon. You have a lot of young players. This is your first game back at a World Cup in so long. I think looking at the process is important. I think the process was excellent.
As well, this gives Canada something to build on heading towards Croatia and Morocco. And you saw that Canada did get a decent amount of opportunities, including in the 80th minute when Courtois had to come up with his biggest save from open play, at least, on a Larin header that was floated to the far post. Maybe didn't get enough pace on the header that he would have wanted, but that was probably Canada's best chance of the day, I would say.
Yeah, that was one of them. There was an opportunity where David was at the top of the box. He received a beautiful pass from Tejon Buchanan right across the face of goal. And instead of laying it across to a wide open Richie Larea, just on like the right side of the center of the box, he opts to shoot with a sea of Belgian defenders right in front of him. And you could see Larea just had his hands on his head going, oh my God, you did not pass it to me. Like, he was absolutely mystified. Even I, when I saw David receive the ball, I was like, oh my God, Richie's open. And then didn't pass it. And I turn to Christian Jack again and I go, that was odd. You never see David kind of miss opportunities like that, which I think lends credence to the whole argument of it really was just one of those days where if everything could have gone wrong just in that area in terms of the ruthlessness, everything did go wrong.
And moving on to Croatia and Morocco, and we'll get into those games a little bit later in the podcast, but how much of the offensive threat that the XG shows will carry through in those next two games?
That Morocco game is going to be interesting because I think, like Canada, they very much thrived in the chaotic situations. And I feel like against Croatia, the interesting thing is, I don't know if Croatia is going to replicate this exact thing. I know we all watched that game. There were a lot of opportunities where Croatia could have hit Morocco in transition and then just chose not to. And I'm pretty sure that was because we don't want to get torched ourselves. The big difference between Croatia and Belgium from a Canadian perspective is that midfield is far stronger than Belgium's. You try to press the man for man, good luck, you're going to be chasing shadows all night. They have very capable ball-playing defenders led by Josko Gvardiol, of course, who is already one of the hottest center-back prospects in Europe. So I feel like they're not going to go entirely man for man in that regard. But when it comes to the XG and whatnot, I feel like you can still produce a certain amount of chances because there are going to be times when, honestly, Borna Sosa is going to be completely free to be exposed. Ivan Perisic was kind of lackadaisical tracking back. Even Josip Juranovic at times didn't have a lot of support. So I feel like there's still going to be opportunities to produce a decent amount of chances. But to the level that we saw against Belgium, especially now that the cat's out of the bag regarding how Canada's, or at least how Canada can play, I'm not so sure.
Yeah, we'll see about the Croatia game. Croatia, there's a lot from that game that, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how Canada matches up. Like, I think, you know, when Borna Sosa gets forward, that's something to contend with if you're Canada, okay, dealing with that overlap threat. But one thing that Canada will probably be pretty happy with is that Croatia wasn't really keen to hit on the counter. And the thing is, they just don't really have the legs to hit on the counter. Like, Andrej Kramaric, false nine, great at finding pockets. He's not going to be somebody who's going to stretch the field. No. You know, you look at it as well, like Vlasic when he was on, or, you know, all the other options that they had out wide. They're not necessarily guys that stretch out the field. Ivan Perisic as well, he's more of someone who just, he likes to get on the ball in deeper areas. And that kind of sums up the Croatia team. So it's going to be a bit of a different battle because you look at this Belgium game and it ended up being such a track meet at times because Belgium was just like, okay, let's just get the ball forward and, you know, try to play through Canada's press. And Canada was smart to play that press they did against Belgium because they genuinely made Belgium uncomfortable. They were able to do that because Belgium played a double pivot and Canada did well enough to pinch off the double pivot and press and limit the wingbacks. Whereas against Croatia, because they play a back four and they play with the midfield three, they're going to have no issues playing through that. So Morocco, as we saw Morocco had to get bodies behind the ball every time. And they did a great job of it. I mean, that's, again, why the game was so low scoring. It was 0.52 XG to 0.37 in favor of Croatia. It was pretty much a you know, very even game in that regard. So I think if you're Canada, there's some things that you like okay, Croatia's not going to hit as much in transition, but also Canada's going to have to sit back. They're going to have to watch a lot of Modric, Brozovic, and Kovacic just playing the ball around in the spaces. But also, I think if Canada can pin back Croatia's fullbacks and maybe catch, you know, a Croatian midfielder in a bit of a transition moment. So there were a few times where there were some uncharacteristically sloppy mistakes from Croatia that led to transitions from Morocco. One thing I found with Morocco is when they broke lines, they actually got some really good looks, like especially yes. when they got it to Ziyech. Morocco lacked pace. That was one thing that if they had some pace, there were a few moments where, you know, Hakim Ziyech was on the ball and he was looking for runners that just weren't there. Youssef En-Nesyri is not going to be a track star. Sofiane Boufal is more of a cut inside and make something happen. So if you're Canada, you look at that, there's some chances with their speed again to be a problem against Croatia. And then the Morocco game's fantastic. I think their defense is just criminally underrated. And I think their performance shows that. Like, Naif Aguerre was a force back there. the West Ham man, and Roman Saiss, I thought was a warrior. You look at Mazraoui and Hakimi as well, the performances that they had, like, Amrabat was, you know, fantastic in midfield. So Morocco is going to present a bit of a different test. But again, like much like Croatia, when they did get their fullbacks forward, there was space. It's just Croatia didn't have the speed to burn that. So funnily enough, for Canada, it's going to come down to their speed in this next two games to determine those chances and if they can get XG and really hurt those teams.
And I do think that Canada could get caught in a bit of a track meet with Morocco, especially just considering the pace that Morocco can also present, as well as their ability to hold up the ball and play through midfield. But when we look back at this Belgium game, Canadian Footy FC asks, thoughts as to why Canada could not score even though they created numerous chances?
Again, Thibaut Courtois, the fact that the Belgian defense were putting in some terrific blocks, the fact that uncharacteristically, Jonathan David made some pretty strange decisions. The fact that Kyle Larin just maybe didn't get enough venom on his shots or took an extra touch. All the things that we touched on, really. It was just a cacophony of everything that could go wrong. The actual application of the tactical plan was excellent for the most part. I mean, there were probably two 15-minute spells where Belgium kind of grabbed control, started hitting Canada in transition. Like, I remember specifically right around the 32nd minute or so, maybe the 33rd minute. It was whenever Eden Hazard had that terrific touch, spun around Alistair Johnson and then countered the other way. That was around the time when Belgium kind of started to drag the double pivot out wide. And then in doing so, De Bruyne would drop deep and then he would collect an outlet pass from whoever it was, Tielemans or one of the Belgian defenders. He'd turn around, go the other way because there was tons of space to run into. Those were probably the two times when you could say, yes, this is when Canada is now starting to look second best. But honestly, you can't really criticize anything else other than the ruthlessness, as we said.
Yeah, I think ultimately it's going to come down to finishing. They created their chances in terms of volume. And honestly, for the most part, they limited Belgium. The fact they kept Belgium to less than 1xG, single-digit dot shots. Again, for all this talk of Canada having a weak defense and all this, it's another instance where, again, the sum of the parts is maybe greater than some of the individual parts. And again, some of the individuals were fantastic. Kamal Miller does have to be credited for his defensive performance. Even a guy like Alistair Johnson had a sneaky good performance. Steven Vitoria, other than the goal, you know, had an overall solid night in terms of limiting those chances and making some great interceptions. So Canada's defense, again, if they're going to defend like that, they held the number two team in the world. The team we've talked at length about Kevin De Bruyne. On paper, I have Belgium as the best attack, and they limited them to less than 1xG and, you know, one goal. Obviously, no Romelu Lukaku does change that discussion a bit. But again, if you're Canada and you saw what you just did to De Bruyne and company, if you're looking at Croatia, say, again, fantastic midfield, I'm looking at a guy like Kramaric, Vlasic, you know, Perisic, that front three. Again, it's nothing. It's not like it's a huge step up from what Belgium, you know, threw up with Hazard and De Bruyne and Batshuayi. You know, you look at Morocco in terms of Ziyech, Boufal and Nasir. Again, it's not a different proposition. So if they keep defending like that, it's fine. Metaphorically and in the attack, the best way to put it is, if you're going to use a hockey term, they were gripping their sticks a bit too tight. And if you're going to use a soccer term, they just looked a bit stiff. I think what they need, if anything, is a goal. And maybe that's what the biggest part of the penalty frustration is less, okay, what happened with the penalty? Because, again, they missed a penalty, still should have scored after that. I don't think, again, it's the one thing with the penalty discussion, maybe just to bring it up and then end it for the rest of the show, is that the penalty is frustrating, that it could have given Canada the confidence boost they needed in front of goal to later score.
Yes.
And I think there were a lot of moments where Canada created enough chances to win after the penalty. I think that's not the problem. It's just the penalty could have given them the confidence to go out and score. And I think that's what they need right now. They just need a shot, because a lot of their moments aren't just them lacking incision. It's them looking like they're second guessing themselves, that they're unsure of their ability to score at this level. And for a striker, those sort of thoughts can be a death knell.
Yeah, exactly. And then if you get that penalty to go in, you're like, okay, great. The pressure's off. Our first goal at a World Cup is scored. Let's kind of go for it. And then if you end up missing 2, 3, 4 chances in a row, you're like, you know what? It's fine. We got our goal. It's going to come. You don't doubt yourself as much. I feel like as it keeps building up and building up and you're still looking for the first goal, it kind of sets in like, oh my God, are we ever going to score today? And you just feel like everything's against you. So it is also mostly just for the mental block.
And yeah, that's the thing with Canada. The first goal, that's, it's something that you could tell does way. There's a few times where guys maybe shot and you're almost seeing like their eyes light up like, oh, I have the chance to score the first goal. And that's understandable. You want that sort of confidence. You want that desire for players to take on that responsibility. But it can also be a weight where there's times where you hesitate. You're like, oh, should I take that shot? Can that be the first goal? And ultimately, if you're going to be finishing at this level, it just has to be on your foot, off your foot. It can't be, okay, is it going to be this? Is it going to be that? And I think, again, yeah, that's the one regret ultimately that you can have with the penalties, that you would have liked it to go in this stage for confidence reasons. But I think if this is a club game, for example, Canada goes on and scores after missing the penalties. Just one of those where, again, it felt like they were just a bit stiff in front of goal. So look for that. Well, I'm curious to see, like, because it's one of those things where either you just snap your fingers and Canada's going to look really confident and you're going to be like, okay, that was gone, or they're going to genuinely need that first goal to go in by some, you know, divine intervention for them to get their confidence back. So it's going to be an interesting battle to follow, just because goal scoring and finishing and all those things are confidence based, and sometimes confidence cannot be an X and O or a white and black thing.
And when you look at this game as well, Canada, of course, struggled late to score. They sort of faded later in the match after dominating for the first hour, sort of 70 minutes. But DCF asks, would you have brought in Cavallini or Ugbo in the last 15 to attempt to break down the defense in a different way? Of course, Larin did create chances himself, but it wasn't necessarily what Cavallini or Ugbo could offer. Very different attackers in the way they're profiled.
I don't know. I feel like the substitutions, Herdman pretty much got them all spot on, to be honest. Like, they all fit an exact need in that moment. Larin came on to kind of offer a little bit more of that support for David and offer more of a central presence. He could drop deep, make those late secondary runs, because that's the thing. Belgium's defense was staying relatively compact to a certain point, but they were leaving a lot of space in front of them because the midfield wasn't really coming back and helping. And then with Witzel tucking in as kind of another center back, that complicated things even more. So Larin fit a need in that regard. Ishmael Kone came in and looked incredibly poised. Can't believe the kid is 20 years old. And we were going to go through this whole song and dance again, but I mean, terrific performance from him. Liam Miller comes in to inject some more fresh legs and pace to run a tiring Belgian defense. I could go through the whole list, but they all fit a specific need. So I feel like you could have brought in Ugbo and Cavallini. I don't know if they would have had the same impact Larin did, because there wouldn't have been a whole lot of space, at least for Ugbo, to maybe run into. He could have found a way, I'm sure. He's a quality enough striker. But I think in that moment, Larin was the right call there.
I think Larin was the right call. Ultimately, I think if anything, he could have maybe came in a little earlier, just because one, again, another frustrating thing about the finishing is that Jonathan David was getting a lot of aerial balls. And it's just, again, if you're going to be doing that, if you're going to be playing that way, you should just have Kyle Larin on the pitch, just because he's going to be much better at attacking those balls. So if anything, I felt like he could have came in slightly earlier. But I also think you have to recognize that John Herdman probably wasn't able to fully implement his subs plans purely on the fact that his two midfielders weren't able to go 90. I also think that's something that's maybe a bit, you know, that kind of impacts things in that I think the Adekubi was going to come on no matter what. I think, and again, he really livened the game. I thought Liam Miller was a great sub. I mean, Peter and I kind of, talked about it pre-game that we're like, oh, this game kind of screams Liam Miller, funnily enough. And then it ended up happening, yep, which is kind of hilarious, because just like Canada needed the speed and the ability to stretch Belgium's defense late in the game. So those two subs were always going to happen. Larin was going to happen. I mean, Ismael Kone was going to come on at some point, or Jonathan Osorio. I think just for Canada, what went against Cavallini or Ugbo is that Herdman had to bring on both Osorio and Kone for Hutchinson and Ustakin. I think if you're in an ideal world where both are fully fit, you're expecting both of them to go the 90. Maybe you'd take one off for a more attacking a midfielder. And I think that's where a guy like Cavallini could have came on. Because I think personally, Cavallini would have been a great sub in this game late on, just when the game died out. That Canada did feel like they needed a bit of that disruption and chaos that Cavallini brings, which is why he's such a good sub, because he can kind of destabilize the game state and make defenders uncomfortable. But I also thought that Herdman, all of his subs, like Peter said, were bang on and were apt to what he needed. Like, his midfielders weren't able to go 90. I thought he did a great job. Like, he brought in you know, a 20-year-old in Ismail Kone and a guy in Jonathan Nzori hasn't played much, and those two looked excellent in midfield. And I think, again, it was credit to some of the subs that he made.
And when you look at the Canadian defense as well, we saw astounding performances from Kamal Miller and Alistair Johnston. Kamal Miller, I think, was probably Canada's best player on the pitch on the day. He won 3 or 4 ground duels, made 2 interceptions, 2 tackles, and completed 85% of his passes, did well to advance the ball up the pitch, gain the ball, and advance it to the midfield, whether that was to Davies in a bit of a free roll in front of him or centrally to Vittorio or Eustáquio. I thought Miller was astounding and really introduced himself to the world stage, to people who didn't necessarily know Kamal Miller coming from CF Montreal. And Alistair Johnston, sure, he got a yellow card, and that can be a little bit worrying moving forward and a little bit questionable in terms of missing a potential match because of yellow card accumulation. But I thought he did quite well as well. And that's what DCF asks. Did Kamal Miller earn himself a transfer to Europe with that performance?
Yeah, he just might have. And in fact, Alistair Johnston might have also just earned himself a transfer because Celtic is closing in on a deal for him. So, and honestly, very well deserved at that stage. But for Miller, I was pleasantly surprised how good he was in transition, to be honest. Because there were many times when he was isolated, there was no midfield cover to speak of, and he got his tackles timed perfectly right. And that last-ditch challenge on Batshuayi in the first half, my jaw dropped to the floor in the media tribune. All I could think was, oh my God, like he's on it today. And from that moment on, he just kept producing glorious moment after glorious moment and some of the most vital interventions I think I've ever seen any Canadian defender make under John Herdman, to be honest, in that game. And yes, he had one little mishap where it involved Larea having to come back and then make a last-ditch tackle himself. But other than that, a flawless performance. He was the man of the match by far. And I don't think it was even particularly close. There were maybe a couple of candidates who could fit in there, like Atiba Hutchinson, I thought looked very good. But considering Kamal Miller finished the 90 and had that performance, by far and away the man of the match. And I'm sure a lot of European clubs, especially when it came to his distribution under certain pressure, I think they're going to look at that and say, you know what, this could be a possible value buy for us in the next year or so.
And Kamal Miller has to be looked at just because his ball progression is solid. I mean, you look at the Montreal numbers, it's a lot of green on his percentiles chart. He does a great job of progressing the ball and getting it up. And I think he did a great job. There were a lot of times where he was put under duress, you know, him and Johnson. I think another underrated part about their play is outside center backs. There was a lot of time where Steven Vittori and Milan Borin would loft them these balls and they had Belgian runners sprinting at them and they were able to bring down the ball and progress it without much worry. And that was something where I wondered if, you know, Canada's nerves were going to be heavy touch, to disrupt that. So Kamal Miller was excellent in his ball progression, but just defensively, he's super underrated at that. He knows when to go to ground. Like the one thing I've noticed with Kamal Miller is that he rarely makes a bad slide, you know, tackle. He's rarely making a big tackle where he's overcommitting self. Like the one time he missed a slide in this game was what he got stepped on. It was that one, that weird one where he like slid in and he got stepped on and then Belgium, you know, got in transition, but there were so many. Like there's that one where he came flying across to cover Johnston's side and made that huge tackle late on to give Canada a chance. Like, he's just so good at timing his sliding challenges. He's got, you know, good enough foot speed when, again, we talk maybe about on the turn. Well, if he's facing the game straight on, he can do some damage. So I think a guy like Kamal Miller, he's got a lot of great tools. And I think if a team in Europe looks at him, they're, you look at the price tag, I think he could certainly be a bit of a sneaky buy. And if you're a team with a back three and you want a left-footed center back, I think he's a guy, again, who deserves to go to Europe. And I think it's great to see him shine on the stage like this against a top, top team to kind of show what he's so good at. That's the thing about the Kamal Miller game that was great. It wasn't just that he was excellent. It was that a stereotypical Kamal Miller performance, and it was Kamal Miller at his best, and he's shown on the perfect stage.
And from Blair Donnelly, thoughts on Tejan Buchanan's performance? I thought he moved the ball well, but his crosses and finishing were poor. He needs to do better, in his opinion.
Yeah, I feel like him and Hoylett almost were in the same boat in that they had their moments. Like, there were certainly one or two balls that they played in that were sublime, and they were causing problems at times for the Belgian defense with their trickery on the ball, but it wasn't consistent the whole time. And I think Buchanan, as well as Hoylett, kind of fall into that category of almost like what I mentioned with Davies earlier, probably like a 6, 6.5 out of 10 rating is probably what they deserve just based on what they produced. A lot of people, though, like outside of the Canadian media and Belgian media, who've obviously become familiar with them recently, were quite impressed with what Buchanan has to offer. But in a lot of ways, I feel like his performance was mostly sizzle and less steak, if that analogy sort of makes any sense.
Yeah, Buchanan is an interesting one because I think he in these big games, he's so good just because he has no fear and he's going to run at guys and he's going to cause chaos. I mean, he won the penalty. He delivered a lot of good balls into the box and he had some great take-ons. But it's also something where, you know, you do almost wonder that, like, it's going to be one of those things where he's still, I think, putting together the entire package in terms of decision-making, in the sense that sometimes knowing when to go at guys, sometimes knowing when to pass inside and then look for that cross. But I thought ultimately, I just like the way Buchanan takes the ball and drives at guys and makes things happen. And he's a bit of a destabilizer. And when he generates those looks, it does cause problems. So I thought overall, I thought Tejan Buchanan was very solid. And I thought he did well in the games. It just felt like maybe there were a few times where the end product was a bit uncharacteristically off. Like there was that one shot where it cut into him and I thought Buchanan was going to rifle it low into the corner like he's so good at doing. And he overhit it a bit. But that was, again, kind of emblematic of Canada's finishing, because I thought he did a great job of generating a lot of good looks for Canada with his dynamic, you know, explosive 1v1 play. Again, it just is so destabilizing for defenses, the way he can shift, get past a defender and just whip in a dangerous ball into the box.
And from Canamenti and Doha, given the way the game was played and the goal unfolded, the goal against Canada, was Vitoria caught out? Was this type of game one that might have benefited from Atiba playing center back?
The only glaring errors that Vitoria made were ironically in like the one area that you would have the most confidence in him in, and that's aerially. Like, he looked very uncertain in those situations. And we saw it play out for the goal, of course. There were times, I think, in the second half when he kind of grew into it and he kind of pushed up and made some pretty solid interceptions and then, you know, passed the ball off to somebody and sort of, you know, recycle possession in that way. I thought he did a really good job at that. But I don't know how much of a difference Atiba would have made in those situations, to be honest. With Vitoria, when he has a day where he struggles in the air, that's one of those where you kind of chalk it down to one of those games.
Yeah, I don't know. Vitoria, I thought, had a really solid game. It was just one of those where the one moment that he was off just happened to end up in his net. And that's the frustrating thing, because there, again, you look at the goal, it made no sense just because he kind of fell asleep and he kind of swatted his foot at a ball. Usually he'd just run at and thump with his head. And, you know, he kind of, you know, his indecisiveness allowed Batshuayi to run off of Kamal Miller's blind spot and into Vitoria's, you know, behind Vitoria to score. So it was a bit of a frustrating moment, just, you know, not only because it was a goal that was avoidable, but also because that's Vitoria's bread and butter, is just a high ball coming at him and all he has to do is, you know, attack it. But I thought also, on the flip side, there were a lot of good reads he made, especially late in the game, where he thought he would be tired, their tired legs, where he's just so good at stepping out and making those interceptions. And I think it was one of those games where, you know, Belgium wasn't really attacking Canada's defenders 1v1. You know, I think it was one of those where they really tried to play these sort of passes. And that's, again, partly what benefited Alistair Johnson, Kamal Miller, and Steven Vitoria. They made a lot of good interceptions between them and a lot of good sliding tackles. And it really did play to their strengths. So I think it was one of those where I thought Vitoria had a really good game. It was just his unfortunate mistake ended up in the back of his net. And it's one of those where, you know, that's... That's, I guess, again, it shows the margins of this level that you can't even switch off for a half second or the ball is going to end up in the back of your net. But I don't know. I wasn't looking at this game and being like, Vitoria, you know, Atiba Hutchinson needed to be in there for things to change. I certainly think Atiba Hutchinson could have given a different look to Canada, and maybe you get Ismail Kone on the pitch, or maybe you get Samuel Adekugbe on the pitch if you're able to do that. But I'm not looking at it and being like, oh, Vitoria. This was one of Vitoria's really good games, and it's a game that benefited him. And I think what's nice for him is, in this group, you look at the way Morocco and the way Croatia played, I think this will benefit Vitoria, just because there was a lot of high balls, a lot of crossing the box, and not as much sprinting in transition, which are things that he likes.
Vittoria was always going to play this game. He's been a staple of John Herdman's Canadian side for the longest time. He's been dedicated to the national team, and he's been good for the national team, and he was good against Belgium. Yes, there was one moment, but we knew that aerial balls were going to be Canada's weak point, just considering that they're playing a back three. They have Kamal Miller and Alistair Johnston, who are not two of the largest guys, so you have Stephen Vittoria there to win those headers. I thought Atiba Hutchinson did a good job in the double pivot with Stefan Eustachio. Sure, he could only go an hour and Eustachio could only go just over 80 minutes, but I thought that Canada did everything pretty well right other than finishing. But a question from Cam of the Valley. When searching for a goal, Canada has often put Davies central, but it looks like he crowds space and often dwells too long on the ball. Curious what the best strategy to utilize Davies is when the team needs a goal. In Cam of the Valley's opinion, he's best out wide and in some space.
Kind of both of those answers in one is what I'd go for. When he's playing in a free role and he's given license to do as he pleases, then it very clearly works. Because it happened against Uruguay. It's happened in some pretty big games that he's played in for Canada, where when he's played free, and also when the game is chaotic, he really does excel. Yes, there are times when he plays maybe slightly more in a strictly left-sided role, but then occasionally drifts inside. But I just think that's the key. You have to play him free. And I think as long as you do that, then I think you're going to get what you need from Davies in terms of the chance creation, in terms of the goal threat, and just overall attracting attention from defenders.
Ultimately, it depends where the space is on the field for Alphonso Davies, because it depends what teams are throwing at him. I feel like in this game, Belgium did a good job of trying to close down the wide areas, and maybe we talked about why was Yuri Tielemans playing out wide. Maybe that was, again, maybe another aspect of they realized, because it was such an intriguing adjustment. We expected the Tielemans-Witzel double pivot, and then all of a sudden we saw Tielemans like playing out wide. But now that you think about it, maybe this was kind of a way to, because every time Alphonso Davies got the ball on the left, he had two or three guys on him. Meanwhile, Richie Lherey, every time he got on the right, had one. And he ended up making that one look pretty foolish. And Yannick Carrasco, just with how good Lherey was in his 1v1 play in the game, I was very impressed. So Davies, maybe in this game, could have been used a little more central in the sense that Canada needs a goal. He goes inside, a bit of chaos starts, and it frees up space out wide. It's one of those where I think ultimately with Davies, he can be used as a tool depending on what you have and what you need on the field. Because the nice thing is he drags bodies all over the place. So maybe if you're playing a team that you want a little more in the middle, you just leave Davies out wide because you know he's going to attract that attention. But also, you know, maybe later in the game where you have Sam Adekugbe on and who's fresh, you have Liam Miller who's on who's fresh, you want them to use their legs and to stretch out into the space. Maybe you move Alphonso Davies in the middle just to kind of bring the attention there and free up a little more space for Adekugbe and Miller to do those things. So I think it's with Davies, much like his overall position, it's fluid. There's no perfect answer because he can be so destabilizing in wide areas. But as we're also learning is that when he cuts inside and he attracts attention and he gets in that half space, he can also cause a lot of problems for teams in that way as well.
And among the finishing issues for Canada against Belgium were set pieces. Canada had opportunities on set pieces. They had 4 corner kicks. They had 14 free kicks, but they weren't able to connect with very good opportunities off a lot of them. We saw a lot of players take different opportunities. Some players taking opportunities on free kicks that they don't normally get. Davies has taken corners before, but he was taking corners against Belgium. And that's the question from 807 Fisher, as well as Brandon Q, Matt Dirk, and Hoogie Town. And I'll read 807 Fisher. Toilet service on set pieces against Japan was outstanding. Eustachio's today wasn't. Is there potential to see Junior get more out of those next match? Also, why isn't Lherey good enough for Nottingham Forest?
That is the question that I think a couple of people had actually asked in the press box. It's like, oh, they gave up on this guy. That's interesting. In terms of the set pieces, yeah, Hoylett definitely had better quality set pieces than Eustachio did. I don't know what is going on in that regard. And Herdman actually did make it a point to mention that the team needed to do a lot better with set pieces than they did. And that's 100% true, because look at the difference that the set pieces made against Japan. Obviously, Belgium's a little more proficient at defending set pieces than Japan is. But even just having one or two of those opportunities where you kind of at least trouble Thibaut Courtois. You get the defenders thinking twice about certain situations, like, oh, he's going here, we got to make sure, you know, like, just throw a bit of a wrench into that plan, and they just could not do that. Most of the set pieces all night were incredibly disappointing, barely beat the first man, or they just didn't find their intended target in general. So it has to change against Croatia, 100%, if they want to, at the very least, maximize their opportunities to get a result.
Yeah, I was surprised. I don't get why the delivery varies so much. That's honestly the biggest thing about Canada, is that how Jekyll and Hyde they look. Because Canada, their numbers are overall really good. Like, you know, in terms of overall over the course of a big sample size, they do well. But as we've come to learn, it's so feast or famine. Like when they're playing well, it's like Japan, where it's just every set play they put into the box, it's almost a goal. You're just like, oh my, this is impressive. Whereas when they're famine, it's like this Belgium game where it's just like over hit, under hit, clear. Like it's not even like, yeah, it's not like they were losing 50-50s to Jan Vertonghen and Toby Alderweireld. It's these balls are straight up just going over and not even finding a player half the time. And I don't know if there's a solution to that in that regard. But also, I just think sometimes, yeah, it feels like Canada just can maybe, they almost overthink some set pieces, it feels like. It feels like when they just simplify things, I think for a successful set piece strategy with what Canada has is that just, you know, whip into the box, get a lot of movement, get some of their big guys onto the flicks. One thing I found interesting is that Canada actually, dating back to the start of the Ocho in September of 2021, they've scored seven set pieces since then, like that aren't penalties, of course, because those can't count as set pieces. And five of those were corners, two of those were free kicks. And what I found interesting was that four of those all came off second phase moments of set pieces. So for whatever reason, they're really good at whipping a dangerous ball into the box, having a team scramble to clear it, and then Canada just kind of capitalizes on that, wins the ball back, and then gets the defense while they're not set. Or they've been flick-ons. Like Canada actually, I think if I'm not mistaken, they've only scored once directly off a set piece since Ocho, the start of the Ocho, like to now. And that was, if you can remember, Kyle Larin, of course, against Mexico. And that was a free kick where it was, okay, he ran directly and he hit it in. All the other six other set pieces, off the top of my head, from what I remember, it's like Vitória's goal against Japan. It's a flick on from Atiba Hutchinson. He scores. Or it's like against Panama, where it was an own goal, but it was a great ball to Tejan Buchanan. He flicks it into a dangerous area. It goes in as an own goal. Or it's a second phase moment. So I just think for Canada, I just find that telling, because in this game, it felt like they're going for a home run shot each time, whereas simply they should just try to whip it into a dangerous area, get some flicks on, get some movement, get some chaos, because I think that's when they've looked best at their set pieces. Yet for whatever reason, they kind of vary between that approach of looking for that home run ball versus, I think that's something that Hoylett's very good at. He doesn't always look for that home run ball, where someone like Eustachio, to his credit, when he finds that home run ball, it's stunning. But also there are a few times where he does overhit the set piece and you're wondering if he's maybe just looking for that pinpoint diagonal and seeing Victoria's head, when set pieces can be so much more chaotic and simple than that.
And from Jordan Essie, do you think Canada should have taken a bit more of a measured approach in that first half? I believe we were gassed out by around the hour mark, and the game changed a bit when Atiba and Junior Hoylett were subbed out.
I don't think so, because look at all the chances that they did ultimately create and the havoc they were wreaking on Belgium, right? They draw a penalty, probably could have had a couple more. I know we're going to get into that very shortly. Everything pretty much went according to plan, and then they go a goal down just before halftime. You can't really dial it back at that point, especially when it, for the most part, was working. I know I mentioned some of the issues at times that Belgium were kind of exposing, but it didn't really slow down Canada all that much until maybe around minute 75 or 76, probably just around, coincidentally or not, the time Buchanan seemed to have pulled up with something. Honestly, had they scored that penalty or one of those chances goes in, completely different conversation. I think that it was certainly the right way to go.
And again, I think what's nice is, A, the goal didn't come off of the direct of their high press. So their high press worked to perfection. It came off a long ball.
It did.
And look at the effects of what Canada's press did to, I think that was probably the most impressive part, was how good Canada's press was. Belgium made two halftime subs just to, like, yes, stem the tide. Like, that's the one thing that's maybe forgotten, that like Yannick Carrasco had to get subbed off because it just felt like he was just getting manhandled by Richie Larea. Like, Yuri Tielemans got subbed off at halftime for, you know, Amadou Onana just because they needed some sort of solidity in midfield or else they were going to get run off the park. Like, a guy like Kevin De Bruyne, he's so incredibly composed. But I guess one part of him playing at Manchester City, and maybe this was something that Herdman scouted, and if this is the case, like, full credit to John Herdman. Kevin De Bruyne at Manchester City, he plays against a lot of low blocks. What does that mean is that there's a lot of moments where Kevin De Bruyne, maybe he's, for lack of a better word, he's like, he's walking around, he's coasting around. And that's not in a bad way. It's just like when you're up against a low block, you're not having the sprint. It's not transition. You're kind of more having to be measured. You're trying to pick the perfect pass. And that's what Kevin De Bruyne is doing. What Canada did was, it was heavy metal pressing. It was like, okay, make Belgium run. And what I found fascinating is that Kevin De Bruyne gassed out. In the last like 30 minutes, Kevin De Bruyne was, he would get the ball in transition moments. Say, okay, this is it. This is Kevin De Bruyne and his bread and butter. He's beaten the Canadian line. And it just looked like he'd run a marathon. It looked like he was swimming in a pool, but he was in the deep end. And he'd been swimming and he couldn't keep his head above water. And I think there are a lot of Belgian players that felt that way because of Canada's press. And I think what it allowed Canada late in the game to continue to play aggressively, because every time Belgium would get a counterattack, they were gassed. So I think it was kind of one of those flip sides where Canada's plan ultimately, again, I think it worked to perfection. You see the chances generated. You see the lack of chances that they were able to get out of Belgium. You look at the fact that Belgium just looked exhausted. They looked at a loss for answers in terms of how they played. Again, it's like Peter mentioned, if you get the early goals, it was one of those where it maybe hinges on you scoring early to really take full advantage. But I thought they did well to limit Belgium and really frustrate them. Because of that, I'm hard to say, like, oh, I think if it was one of those where maybe you let Belgium get comfortable and later in the game when Canada was pushing for a goal, they would have been burned had they not played as aggressively and as heavy metal as they did.
And one of the other aspects of this game that a lot of people were looking at was the refereeing. Jenny Sikwaze of Zambia had some questionable calls, even though he did get it right on the Alphonso Davies penalty kick, of course, not going in. Vince Wright, Jason Poulton, Damien Brin, and On the Rise all questioned the offside from the Belgian pass back that resulted in a foul on Buchanan in the box and not getting a penalty. I was confused. I think most people in Canada were confused by that call. It seemed like it went against the laws of the game.
I literally said in that moment, what the fuck are they doing? That's not offside, and that's a foul. Like, it was a back pass from a Belgian player. Yes, okay, to a Canadian in an offside position, but it's negated. It's canceled out. It's not a thing. It's moot once a Belgian player makes that action. So then you end up fouling him, and that was a foul, by the way. You stomp on a player. Doesn't matter whether you get the ball or not. It's reckless. It's a yellow card offense. So should have been a penalty, yellow card, no offside. Don't know what they missed there. The Larea call, it's one of those that for me was 50-50, because I feel like in MLS, he always gets that call. And I think that's why he went down when he did, because he's just so used to it. It's like reflex at this point. Could have been given, could have been not. That one wasn't as egregious to me as the offside call that wasn't. But in general, the officiating was very, very inconsistent for both teams too. Like, there were moments when I think Belgium kind of got screwed out of some fouls that led to some pretty dangerous moments from a Canadian perspective.
I think the penalties were the Buchanan one is the most egregious, because I think ultimately there were four penalty shots for Canada, and I think three were correctly awarded. As in, the Tejan Buchanan was a no-brainer. Like, that was a good call. Like, as in the early one, I mean, like, the one that was the handball. There's also one later where Stakio hit Tielemans. I think that was the right call. Tielemans' hands were close to his chest, and it was fine. I think the Richie Larea one was fine, just because Richie, Larea did get fouled, but the problem is he leaned too much. Like, he initiated too much contact, and you're always, when it's not called on the first look, you're never going to get that from VAR when you lean as heavily as he did. And I think that's just one where Larea, usually he's, I think, again, it was just a tackle from Witzel where he did catch Larea, but it was one where Larea leaned enough to kind of take away the no doubtiveness about it in the mind. The Buchanan one, that one was certainly a miss. I mean, I guess, I mean, I'll
I'll rewatch it again to see where the referee was positioned. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt that maybe he just genuinely thought Canada played the ball or that there was a deflection. What I don't get with the play is why did he blow the whistle when typically there's so many offside calls now that they let go that are so iffy where it's like, okay, just let the play run out. And if it's offside, then let VAR intervene. That was the one thing, because his early whistle then, you know, obviously negated the impact for them to even really review if Tejon Buchanan was fouled or not. So that was the one miss for me, was just, I don't get why he was so, you know, in a hurry to blow his whistle on that when they've typically been quite, you know, they usually wait now with the, for the offside call. But I thought that he did get the other three penalty calls straight, pretty much, you know, I didn't have any too many complaints with them based on what we saw. But yeah, I think that was just the one missed call because, yeah, like you mentioned, the game was inconsistent. But overall, from at least from my first watch, I thought it was relatively inconsistent, maybe, but consistent as in, like, you kind of knew where the foul was. There weren't many times where you're looking, you're like, okay, that's like, you know, differs what was going on. I think as players, you can be fine with that because, again, ultimately you want some sort of consistency, be it bad, good, or somewhere in between.
Yeah, and I do think it became throughout the game a little, as you say, consistently inconsistent, where the players started to realize that they're not going to get the calls that maybe they're used to in their domestic leagues. And of course, it is a questionable referee. There's the possibility that he ended that match in AFCON due to a potential heat stroke. Also, match fixing accusations in that as well. So it is a questionable refereeing appointment, but I don't think that there was necessarily anything wrong with the way he officiated that game outside of maybe a couple of the penalty calls, especially the one on what would have been the offside. But as we look forward to the next game as well, what would be your projected 11 for a Canadian team approaching a game against Croatia?
So this one I've given a fair amount of thought to. I think with the yellow card warnings being what they are, and then the Buchanan potential fitness concerns, I mean, I guess we'll get some answers about that in training tomorrow. That'll be Friday, the 25th. I will be sure to get some information on that front. But based on what we have seen and as it stands right now, I think Richie Larea keeps his place. I think Adekubi checks in for Johnston just because of the yellow card issue. And then you're going to see Vitoria and Miller end up keeping their places. That's the back four with Borjan in goal. I think from here, this is where it gets very fascinating. I don't think the midfield changes, but I wonder if Buchanan gets dropped or Hoylett gets dropped and a third midfielder comes in, whether it's Osorio or Kone. I don't know which one, but either one I feel it has a really realistic chance, because I think more than anything, if you're going up against Croatia, you need to match up with them in that midfield trio, or at the very least have one of your wingers always being diligent and kind of helping out with the cover in that regard. So if I had to pick one or the other, I'll just lean with the midfielder right now. I might change my mind in a couple of days, so I'll just say one of Osorio or Kone, just to be safe there. And then Davies and David play up front, with probably Hoylett still keeps his place as well, because I feel like he can maybe offer a little extra protection too, and then he can maybe play with a bit of a box if you want.
Yeah, we always ask this question at the worst times, just because it's like, I don't know. I rarely make a projected 11 this early, just because there's so much that can change. But off the top of my head, well, I'd say, yeah, Alistair Johnston could drop out due to the yellow card concerns. I think you might want him against a Morocco, just due to the way that Sofiane Boufal likes to play. Whereas, again, that guy like Perisic, maybe it'll be good just to have a guy like Larea on him, kind of dogging him in a sense. So I don't know, looking at this, what I think off the top of my head, and again, we'll see how confident I'm this of in a few days. I'd say Boyan in goal. I'd say back four of Adekugbe, Miller, Vitoria, Larea. And then to make up the back three, I think what we're going to see is we're going to see a midfield trio of Hutchinson, Eustachio, and I'm just going to go Osorio for now, but it also very well could be Kone. I think what we'll see is Hutchinson tucks into that right center back role normally occupied by Alistair Johnston, allowing Richie Larea to go forward as he does. My logic for this, again, is the midfield battle needs to be handled in some regard, but also I think you need width, and I think the Larea Adekugbe width would be huge. because what we saw from Croatia is that if you pin back their fullbacks, they tend to struggle. They don't tend to struggle. I mean, they just don't look as, you know, Croatia as they are. I think one thing that was fascinating as well is that Croatia had a really good counter press against Morocco. Like every time Morocco would get the ball, Croatia was really good at counter pressing them in the middle. So I think any sort of width like Adekugbe and Leray who can beat that counter press will be key. From there, that leaves me. I have a 4 and I have a 3, so that leaves me 3 left in the attack. I think I'm going to go Alphonso Davies for sure. I think you're going to get Jonathan David for sure. I think this is a game for now. Actually, I'm edging on Kyle Larin because I looked at Croatia, and one area that hurt Morocco is that it felt like En-Nesyri wasn't stretching their backline enough. And that's one area where I had Kyle Larin out of this Belgium game, and why he didn't start was that you didn't necessarily need to stretch the Belgian line. They stretch it on their own, and you needed more guys running from deeper positions. Whereas against Croatia, I think you need to stretch the pitch as much. You need to get that midfield stretch. You need to get those fullbacks push back. And I think a guy like Kyle Larin could stretch the field and allow them to get the sort of space that Alphonso Davies and Larea and Adekugbe and David need to thrive. So that's why I'm going to go Larin from the starting lap. I'm going to go Larin and one of Osorio Kone slot in for now, but we'll see how that adjusts. But that's kind of my thinking based on what I saw from Croatia, but also the fact when you factor in Johnson on a yellow and also Alphonso Davies on a yellow. So that's another reason to push him higher up the field as I do in this position, just so we can avoid any needless fouls that get some suspended from Morocco, which needless to say would be a disaster.
Time now for Canada Against the Odds, presented by Sports Interaction. Want to bet? You can do it at Sports Interaction, Canada's sportsbook. Every single World Cup game at your fingertips. Bet pregame, live in play, or on one of our many Canada-specific prop bets. Made for Canadians by Canadians, Sports Interaction makes it easy to deposit, play, and cash out. Join now and see that all what sports betting has to offer. Head to bit.ly/NFPOD. That's bit.ly/NFPOD. 19 plus, please play responsibly. And when I was taking a look at some of the prop bets available for Canada against Croatia, one of them that stood out to me was the minute of the first goal. There will be a goal with the attacking talent on the pitch in this game. I don't think these two teams cancel each other out. And there's several options. For me, I'm going to take the 46-60 option. It's plus 600. It's not a massive return, but it seems fairly likely with the way these two teams have played that that's where a goal is going to come. And then at the 60th minute, both coaches tinker with their sides.
That's actually a decent show. What I find interesting is that the odds are so low for the first minute to the 15th minute, because I feel like, if anything, that could be when there's like the least chance that there could actually be a goal scored. But if I were to look at this, I could honestly see Canada possibly themselves scoring, maybe almost pulling a Belgium and getting one like right before halftime. So like in that 31-45 range, I feel like could actually have some value there, which could be interesting. But, you know, I feel like regardless of who the team is, I feel like it's going to almost play out similarly to what that Morocco-Croatia game was, where maybe it's a bit of a frenetic start. Eventually, teams start to trade blows and then they kind of settle down a bit and then it'll just delve into however it goes into. I feel like it might be a while till we see the first goal in this game.
Yeah, it's been a bit of a weird World Cup in terms of first goals, because it feels like most games, if there's an early goal, there's going to be multiple goals. Like we've seen a lot of that where there's early goals and the games get wide open, like Australia, France, or Spain, you know, Spain, Costa Rica on the flip side of that. You know, even Argentina, Saudi Arabia, there's been a few late comebacks. But really, other than Senegal, Netherlands, pretty much that's like the only game where there's really been like a late goal. Like for the most part, if you make it to the 60th minute, nil-nil, that scoreline tends to hold for the most part, as we've seen across the games. But because, yeah, like literally it's just the Netherlands-Senegal game was the only game where it was nil-nil and it was just scored that late. So I'm going to say that trend bucks, and there could be a late goal just as teams wear out. Teams are eventually going to bend and break as they find their legs. And I think teams are going to realize the importance of finishing the game strong. So I'd say I don't mind the late options, because you do get better odds for scoring later against in this game. It was something like you can get plus 860 for 61-75, which I don't think is a terrible shout as the game really starts to open up. And even 76-90 is plus 1100. So say it's a nil-nil game and one of the teams really needs a win, they open up their, you know, they really start to run and open the field. All of a sudden, it could be apt for a first goal, assuming there is none scored by that point of the game.
I think Canada will have to do what they can to avoid any yellow card accumulation suspensions, because if you take another yellow card and that Morocco game becomes a must win, you don't want to be missing your first choice lineup. So that is going to be integral for this Canadian team. And I would say that Larin also starts up top, not just because he suits the Croatian backline well and his ability to get in behind, but also just what he did in his substituted performance against Belgium. He showed that he can get on the end of opportunities and create those chances for himself as well. So I wouldn't be surprised to see him start as well as the four at the back that you suggested. And from Paul Newmark, what would you say your key takeaways would be as we look towards Croatia and Morocco, the good, the bad, and the ugly beyond that penalty attempt?
I can't wait to see how Canada's midfield sets up, because they're definitely not going to go man for man. I definitely highly doubt that. I'm sure they're almost going to do something similar to what Morocco kind of did, in that they're going to have like one of the midfielders screening whoever's kind of in possession from those deeper areas, whether that's one of Croatia's center backs or potentially Brozovic. And then you have the deepest lying midfielder, probably Hutchinson in that situation, shadowing the most advanced player. And then you almost have like, at times, maybe man marking on one or two guys, maybe like say Sosa, maybe potentially Kovacic, like that to me is a real possibility. And that's, I think, the best way to possibly approach this. Almost a mixture of zone plus man, I think, is essentially how Canada might approach this off the ball. On the ball, there are going to be transitional moments there, because Croatia does play with a relatively high line, at least. So I'm sure they're going to at times use selective pressing, because I don't think they're going to completely sit back. Morocco certainly didn't sit back. I think there's a lot they could take away from that game and use it to their advantage.
Yeah, ultimately from this game to, I guess, well, the good, I guess we could say that Canada held, you know, did well to, you know, control the initiative, I would say. That was one thing, again, was it was nice to see Canada kind of dictate the game, as in, they looked at Belgium like, yeah, we want you to run. Yeah, we want you to deal with the press. Yeah, we want you to deal with a lot of quick passes and incisiveness. So I thought Canada did well to control proceedings, and that's always going to do well, because I think, again, if you can dictate the terms of which games can be played at, that usually is to your benefit. Ultimately, in this game, it wasn't to be, but I think, again, they do that. Most games are fine. The bad, I mean, just that one defensive lapse, again, shows at this level that you can defend so well all game and you have to be on the ball. And that's something they learned against Japan as well, there, where they defended so well again all game but one moment. So that's a bad. And I guess the ugly is just the finishing. gotta finish your chances, gotta be a little more ruthless, gotta, you know, loosen up a bit when you're taking your shots, when you're in front of goal. But yeah, you're gonna have a fascinating test against this Croatia game. I think Morocco showed that there are areas that you can certainly make Croatia uncomfortable, but also Croatia showed that, I think it was telling, that Morocco played a near excellent to perfect game and Croatia still comfortably got a 0-0 and could have easily won if Yassine Bounou doesn't make a few good saves. So Canada has to be aware that against this Croatia team, the margins are going to be almost finer than they were against Belgium, just because Belgium, we knew they were a bit loose at the back. We knew that there were going to be chances, whereas this Croatia game, you're not going to get that many attempts. You're not going to get that those sorts of looks.
And from Vince Alvarado, do you guys feel better about the next two games after this one? I feel that way, even despite the loss. And I know for me, Canada went out and established themselves on the world stage. And I know that we can sometimes be in our little bubble here where we know how Canada can play, how Canada can attack, and how Canada can implement themselves in games against good teams. We've seen it against Mexico. We've seen it against Uruguay. We've seen it against Japan. But I think what this showed to the greater Canadian public was that Canada can play. And we saw thousands of people out on the streets in Little Italy and Toronto watching Canada play a game. Of course, Italy's not in the World Cup this year, and Canada's there. And so people are adopting Canada as their main team. We saw schools fill gymnasiums to watch games at lunchtime and throughout the day. And that's something that I know personally, I've only experienced through Canadian hockey. And probably my fondest memory of watching games was back in high school. And we were watching Canada versus Latvia at the 2014 Olympics. And Latvia was pushing Canada and everybody was glued to the screen. And yesterday we saw that for the Canadian men's national team. We've seen it in spurts for the Canadian women's national team, but most of their success has been in the summer when people are comfortable being outside and comfortable being in large groups and getting together. We haven't seen that in the winter. People bundled up watching the Canadian men's national team. It's the winter. It's the Canadian men's national team. It's just something that we haven't seen before. And they went out there and they didn't shrink on the occasion. And I think that's the important thing. They didn't show against Belgium that Canada can't play. Canada was out of their depths. They went out, they played, they balled. Estacio stood out against some of the more familiar players in the world. And even just within people I know who don't watch Canadian soccer, there was just this realization that, okay, Canada can actually play now. This isn't the days of Olivier Okien leading the line.
So I see completely where you're coming from. And for sure, there's an element of that, in that it was reassuring to see that they didn't wilt. I don't think there was ever any doubt on my end that they would wilt, or, you know, that their quality would decline in any way, because we've watched this team play very closely for many years now. And I figured they were going to at least keep it competitive, but to see just how much they were taking the game to Belgium, and for as consistently as they did, I think that's really what struck me. It's the fact that it wasn't just for like a 5-minute spell here, then 10 minutes where they had to sit back, and then 5 minutes again. No, like it was consistently and steady, half an hour in pretty much each half, maybe a little longer. And sure, they didn't score, they didn't win. That's the encouraging part. But at the same time, I left the media tribune feeling almost very down, because you just felt like it was an opportunity. Like, yes, they certainly made waves, no doubt about it. But had they scored, had they gotten a point, had they won, which was more than possible, it was almost like a sense of regret, in that this was the game of the two against Belgium, Croatia, that they really could have gotten a result from. I'm a little less hesitant to say that they could get a result against Croatia, but I do think it's going to be tough still after watching that game. So I'm almost in two minds with it, in that they did make the country proud. They did make the fans proud. I'm sure they can come away from the stadium and say, you know what, at least my team was able to show that they belonged and, you know, really captivated a lot of people. But then at the same time, when you're looking at it just from the Canadian perspective, you're like, you know what, that was the chance. They really should have taken it. And the fact that the game panned out the way it did and they lost, it makes it tougher to take.
Yeah, it's one of those where I'm torn, because, again, you can't help but be proud of the performance, no doubt. Again, second best team, you know, by the very flawed FIFA rankings, but still a team that made it to the semifinals last time, where, you know, they were a corner kick away from getting to the finals and had a matchup in the final that I'm sure they would have fancied of winning. You know, that you've seen all these moments that they've had. So I don't know. You look at Belgium, this is a good game, and Canada played excellently. First World Cup, you know, men's World Cup game in 36 years, to go out and not be overcome by the occasion, as teams have often been. I think you have to be happy. But also, this is, again, we talk about this new Canada that, you know, Canada's talking about, John Herdman talks about. I think Canada, again, is beyond the point of just moral victories against some of these teams. Again, unless they're playing like a Brazil, unless they're playing a team like that, like, if you're going to go out and control the play against Belgium, then you should win against Belgium. It's at that point. It's like the same with the Uruguay game. If you're going to outplay Uruguay for vicious parts of the game, well, then you should get a result against Uruguay. So that's kind of the torn of the mind. Again, it's just surreal to think that you're talking about Canada in this way before. It's just get a result against Curaçao get a result against Suriname, and now it's like, okay, go out and beat Belgium. Like, yeah, it's a bit outrageous, but again, that just shows how much the conversation's shifting. It shows how they're playing. They're genuinely playing to go that way. And I think the next step is getting past those moral victories, because again, they're not a bad thing. But again, if Canada's just going to keep playing this well every game, then it, certainly it's a conversation to be had. Because yeah, that's the kind of the where I'm torn on it, where it's like genuinely they're at that point now, and well, hopefully they can keep that up, because they, if they keep playing like that, surely they will get those results.
And you mentioned just the quick rise of the Canadian national team, and when they were approaching the opening game yesterday, I went back just through some of my camera roll and other Canada soccer stuff that I've done in the past, we've done in the past. And Alex, you and I, at the start of this World Cup qualifying cycle, we're doing live shows on YouTube with Sam Rowan previewing Canada's World Cup qualifying games. And I remember that Suriname one. We were all slightly concerned, and a bunch of fans from Suriname tuned in and were telling us that Canada really had no shot. And well, look where Canada is now. So that's why I say it is a positive thing that Canada went into that game and did not shrink to the occasion. But it's also, they do have to start getting over that hump. And a question from Star: what are the chances of us getting out of the group now? Realistically, it might be hard to get even 4 points.
Yeah, it's now in a situation where you can't lose. And that's never a good situation to be in, obviously. The chances are, I would say, okay. They can probably do enough to get a point against Croatia. It's going to be very difficult. And honestly, after seeing Morocco as much as I have for the last 6 months, I've been saying it for a while, people are sleeping on them. That's not even going to be anywhere close to a slam dunk in terms of getting a win. So that's also part of the reason why I feel sad, because there's almost an element of, well, now you know how realistically how long the tournament's going to last from a Canadian perspective, and it's probably only going to be 3 games, because when you lose the opening game, you're immediately under the cosh. That's not to say they can't do it, but this is a very balanced and tough group. It could really go either way. Like, they could very easily get that point against Croatia. Suddenly the momentum is there. They score a goal. They go into that Morocco game. They thrive amidst chaos, get the 3 points, and then who knows, maybe they get through and then they live to see another day. But that loss is making me feel like, okay, now's the time where you have to show that you have that ruthlessness. Do you have it in you? Can you go out there against Croatia, right the wrongs of what happened against Belgium, and actually go for the kill here?
It's one where, yeah, I think this was the missed opportunity to at least get a draw. I think even again, yeah, you should have at least gotten a draw. Maybe on paper you should have got a win, but there's nothing wrong with the draw. The good thing is Morocco and Croatia tied. I think that certainly does tip the favors in terms of now this is Croatia game's a must get points instead of a must win. Had Croatia won in the opening game over Morocco. And the nice thing is this group's so wide open, I find it hard to project. So ultimately, I think if they go out and get a draw or a win, they'll be in good stead, especially because you look at Morocco, Belgium, like that game's going to be fascinating. I could also see another draw. And all of a sudden, if there's a draw, I guess that would put Belgium at 4 points, Morocco at 2. And then if Canada and Croatia tie, it'd be Croatia at 2, Canada at 1, and you head into the final game and it's just everything to play for, which would be a remarkable.
And a few players very much impressed in their substitute appearances against Belgium. And one of those players was Ismaël Koné, and on the rise, VDHS and Cam Owens all ask a very similar question. Ismaël Koné truly looked class and he was amazing when he came on. Could he start the next match?
Yeah, the odds are pretty good that he could. He looked very poised out there. Yeah, there were one or two little mishaps, but overall, I thought he handled himself really well. He was doing his thing. He was dropping deep to collect the ball, swiftly turned around. The hips don't lie. He was able to get forward and hit some terrific passes and got stuck in defensively, too. I could easily see him starting in front of Eustachio and Hutchinson as part of a trio. I don't think it will happen, but he'll certainly get a decent amount of minutes at the World Cup, even in a substitutes role. And that's probably not the best news for Marc-Anthony Kay to hear, because now you've got Osorio and probably Kone ahead of you in the pecking order. So 2023 has just become that much bigger for someone like him.
I think Kone has a shot. I mean, he completed all but one of his passes, had a few good moments defensively. He showed that he's not afraid by the occasion, and we've seen that with Ismael Kone. So I wouldn't be surprised to see him start. Also could see Jonathan Osorio start. Either way, we're going to see a lot of Ismael Kone, and I think that's a good thing because he comes in and he's so calming and stabilizing on the ball. You know, he's going to be able to get on the and do things with the ball. And, you know, we also know he has that X factor, that incisiveness, that ability to just be dangerous on the ball as well, that we maybe didn't see as much of Belgium just because the game state didn't necessarily require it from him. But maybe against a team like Croatia, where they're going to be counter-pressing aggressively, they're going to be trying to close down Canada into certain areas of the field. A guy like Ismael Kone could be a bit of a wild card as a starter or off the bench to kind of break through that with his ball progression his skills.
And he also didn't look fazed by the big stage of the World Cup when he came in against Belgium. I think that might have been a worry for Ismael Kone. Of course, he's had such a meteoric rise over the last year. At this point last year, he hadn't played a professional game, let alone played it at a World Cup. So he now has a few minutes of experience under his belt. And I do think that he could start and sort of pick apart that Croatian team. Mm-hmm. Not that that Croatian team is going to be easy to pick apart by any means, but he could get himself involved in that game. And I think when we look at our potential starting 11s that we'll look at a bit closer to the match, he might be in those lineups. But Herdman, interesting coach. He's always an interesting coach. Came out not in a tracksuit yesterday, didn't have the AirPod yesterday either. Came out full suit, no tie, was well unbuttoned at the top like Alex tends to be. And Peter, I know you enjoy a nice unbuttoned shirt as well. But after the game, made international headlines. After the game, he made international headlines saying, I just told them they belong here and we're going to go and F Croatia next. It's as simple as that. That's what he said to TSN's Matthew Schenetti on the sidelines after the match. With those choice words, Croatian media came to John Herdman's Matchday Minus 3 press conference on Thursday. And Herdman did apologize in some ways, says that he was emotional in that moment. And those were the words that came to mind. With no disrespect to the Croatian national team or the Croatian people. But when you look at Herdman and those comments, what are your thoughts on those post-game comments, specifically the we're going to F Croatia?
I think that is just the confidence talking. John Herdman's always, as we know, been a very confident guy. He wants his team to be confident. And I think it's also a pretty decent strategy too. More Herdman mind games here because he takes the attention off the players, takes the attention off the Davies penalty miss, off of all that other stuff, and puts it squarely on himself. It's actually a classic Jose Mourinho move. So we saw him mimic Marcelo Bielsa in the first game with the man marking. Now he's mimicking his inner Jose Mourinho with the mind games and kind of doing this through the media. So that's personally what I think when I hear that and when I see that, because now all that anybody's going to be talking about in the lead up to this, especially because Croatians, I'm sure, are going to be asking Canadian media, oh, what do you think about John Herdman and all this? And that's going to start dominating all the headlines. I can already see it happening.
I'd say own it. Just You're going to go out and F Croatia. I mean, what do you want him to say, that you're going to go out and get F'd by Croatia? I don't think that's going to go over very well. So it's kind of, again, you rate the confidence and maybe you don't take it. So, of course, Croatia's going to take it personally because – I mean, that's sports. There's always going to be two teams offended. I think the same way that everyone in Canada was offended that teams were like Belgium were like, oh, we're gonna destroy Canada. It's just all part of the game. And credit for Herdman for again maybe deflecting some of the attention and letting it go, because it's one of those things where ultimately, as we've come to learn, those things have zero bearing on the matchup. Or at least very minimal. Like, we see it all the time. Oh, our team's going to win. We see the famous guarantee. And it's one of those where if you guarantee it, you end up forever in lore. But if you go wrong, you don't. But also it gets forgotten. So I think if you're Herdman, why not just say you're out, you're going to go out and F Croatia. Why not? His team went out and dominated patches of play against the second team in the world. So at the very least, we know Canada's going to go out and play without fear. And then from there, soccer, it's a business that will hinge on a few moments of decision that Herdman won't have any control, nor the players. And I think ultimately we know they're going to come out strong, so why not have that that confidence and belief?
Realistically, Canada can go out in this Croatia game and play the way that they want to. Croatia will play the way that they want to, and one of these teams is going to come out the winner. It's fine lines. I know I see that every single time on this podcast, but that's what's going to, it's going to come down to. We've seen that with the Canadian team, with the Croatian team, and Herdman is just bringing that confidence. He's always been a special coach in that way. And I think that confidence just came through in the way he said his post-game comments on the sidelines. And he did clear the air a little bit the next day. Sure, it can add some added motivation, but at the end of the day, it's the players that play the game, and the mind games can only do so much ahead of kickoff. Canada and Croatia kicking off at 11 a.m. Eastern time on Sunday, November 27th. A big second match in the group stage after Canada dropped that first one to Belgium. This has been episode 98 of the Northern Football Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to the podcast. It's always a pleasure to bring this show to you. And Canada back at the World Cup, a disappointing result in the first game, but certainly establishing themselves on the world stage.